Speaker tonight is Colleen, and I heard her speak and I was really impressed, and I asked her to speak, so I'd like to turn the meeting over to Colleen. Colleen, it is all yours.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Colleen. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater, and I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you, Joe, for asking me to speak. It's always an honor to give back in some small way what I've been given through the gift of the 12 steps. Off the bat, just to qualify, I've been abstinent since August 4th of 2002, so I'm coming up on 21 years of abstinence, me willing, and so far so good, one day at a time. My top weight that I know was 311 pounds, so I've been maintaining about 165 to 170 pound weight loss, I guess probably for about 18 and a half years. It's amazing that I've sort of lost track about how long it's been, because as you'll hear in my story, there was no signs whatsoever of me ever living at a healthy body weight. I do have some pictures that I will share just to kind of give you an idea of where I come from. So hopefully you can see these. So, not only just point out what a cute kid I was, but no, just that, like, clearly you can see that getting into sugar and things was an early, that's definitely one of my alcoholic foods. And I was pretty much a normal size kid for the most part. Until I get into, let's see, hopefully if I can scroll down here. Of course, now it's not letting me scroll. So let's see here. Nope. Oh, there we go. Lost my scroll. It was really when I got a little bit older, into my middle school years, that I started to put on weight. I was only really particularly cognizant that it was a problem, and that, like, when I was 10 years old, my mother brought me to Weight Watchers for the first time. So I thought, oh, okay. And my memory of that was, like, there's a bunch of old people here. Now, they were probably in their 20s, but when you're 10, people over like 14 seem ancient. And there was at the time this wall that you had to walk behind to get weighed in. And these were the old type of scales that had the, like, 100 and 150 pound markers on the top and the other one, you know, and it was just this horrible thing. And they had this terrible diet of food that I didn't want to eat. And so I didn't last very long. You know, my mother supposedly did it with me. I honestly remember this thing about, like, really liking, like, their fudge bars or something, but, like, I couldn't have just one of those. Like, what do you mean one? Like, what is the point of that? So, and then my weight just progressively went up. I was a dancer in high school and in college. And then when I finally graduated from college, which is here, you can see I show that in particular because I pretty much ate my way through my bachelor's degree. And then as I moved on, and some of these, like this picture, whatever, where I did do some plus size modeling in college because I thought, you know, I should embrace living large, and it was not really that interesting. And actually, what I found, even though supposedly being larger was more acceptable, they were still trying to get me back down to a size 16. I thought, I don't get it. I thought the whole point was to be more accepting. So then this is me right before I came into program. I was a bridesmaid at a wedding a few weeks before I came into program. And then in the first month of program, I was at the time a school teacher. So this is my school picture that was taken. And, you know, when I first walked into the rooms, I came in, a therapist or whatever had said to me, you might like the OA program. And I was like, why? And she was like, well, because they all share similar experiences with food. And I thought you might like the camaraderie. And I thought she was crazy, but I was so desperate for something. You know, I had gotten to the point where, you know, one does not get to this size because they're not doing a lot of eating. You know, I remember my years, in the food when I was teaching, it was all about, like, I would be going into work on the weekends because I was such a dedicated teacher to work, but I had to stop by all the stores to get my stash. And in fact, I remember early on in abstinence when I was after school or even on a weekend grading, and I wasn't doing this motion, like grabbing for whatever it was in the bag or the bowl or something at the same time. And I thought, this feels weird, you know? And so I got into program. And so after a year of abstinence, I'd lost about 25 pounds. At that point, I had identified a particular alcoholic food that I had released. And then, but it took me about a year into abstinence and into program really to get desperate enough to make changes. And so that's part of why there's such a drastic change between my first and second year of abstinence. And then this is pretty much some pictures of me today. I show this because it was when I got my graduate degree, I did not eat my way through that degree. And then I actually did go back and do some modeling work. And that was really a satisfying experience to be on the other end of it. Still not interested that I like participating in, and I left that years ago. But so, you know, when I came in to program after, you know, growing up, I mean, we all have our experiences growing up. And as far as I'm concerned, life, there's no, like, life is not easy, except maybe on a bumper stick or some over a sticker. But things got really confusing and really scary very early on for me. And so I needed something to fill that, to take care of me in some way. And food happened to be that thing. And, you know, I couldn't wait to be able to figure out how to unscrew bottles off the liquor in the cabinet. And the food worked, you know, cookies, candies, cakes, all the sugary stuff. And then after that, it didn't really matter what I was eating, you know. And as far as, I mean, I'm really the only like true addict in my family. So, you know, my family, everybody's got their stuff, but I'm the only one who sort of managed to qualify myself enough for a program. And so I was kind of alone in that, you know, and that was a lot of how I felt, like, just, I've got to figure things out and I've got to buck up and deal. And, you know, I'm convinced that if the food hadn't worked as long as it had, I would have gone on to harder things. You know, I remember very, pretty early on in my recovery, and I used to go to more open AA meetings because I had more time. And I remember listening to this story, this woman telling her story of how she got into alcohol, and, you know, she became a stripper and she worked and all these things. And it was so interesting because I completely related to her story. I just thought, I totally get that. I just did sort of the reverse end of that, meaning that, like, through my disease, what I did was, like, all that internal havoc, all that internal wreckage, you know, like I blocked myself off on the other extreme, you know, all that extra padding was a nice way of, like, you being able to come in as close as you wanted to, and I couldn't feel it anyways. It was also a nice way of saying back the, you know what, off, don't touch me, you know, because I need this protective seal. And that was something that came to me, I think, shortly after I stopped eating sugar, in that I became aware that, like, I used the weight as a form of protection because I didn't have a voice. I didn't have a voice to say no, or that's not okay, or I'm not comfortable. Or if I did, it wasn't listened to. So there was a certain level of futility, like, well, what's the point? It doesn't make a difference anyways. And I'd spent a lot of my life trying to prove that I was good enough and that I was okay and that it wasn't my fault, you know. And so I was super sweet and I was really kind. I was massively sarcastic, which I think of as being nice girl's anger, because don't you know, I'm not angry. And I remember that, like, in the beginning, like in the big book, when he talks about anger and resentment, and I was like, first of all, I didn't really understand what resentment was yet. And then the anger piece, I literally was like, I don't get it. Like, I'm not angry. I had no idea how angry I was. I just, that wasn't an okay emotion. That was not a feeling you were not supposed to have. Nice girls don't get angry. And, you know, slowly over time, I've learned, like, well, no, there's healthy forms of that. And thank God there are. And so that was also, you know, another form of what I was doing with food, like a nice way to just hurt, because, by the way, my body was the enemy. My body was the problem. It had betrayed me, you know, and I really lived, like, from the neck up. You know, I didn't really have a lot, even as a dancer. It's amazing how out of touch one can be with their own body. And I remember if something went wrong or broke down in some ways, I was angry and pissed off as if I wasn't living in it, you know? And I wasn't an idiot, right? I was an intelligent person. But like for me, honest to goodness, there was not a connection between the weight I was carrying, meaning I was fat. And that was the problem. The problem was that I was fat. The problem wasn't my eating. The problem was that I was fat. And like I said, when I got into program in my late 20s, what really became apparent to me was that like, I couldn't lie to myself about that anymore. Like there was something going on here. And I also couldn't pretend anymore that like my body was not as big as it was. Because in my mind, I mean, I really, like, I remember even like in high school, having this sense of like, I was looking in the mirror, but I didn't see what I was, what was really there. You know, it was like being a reverse anorexic. Like I saw a smaller body looking back at me, you know, because that's what was in my head. And I remember actually in particular in the high school I went to, it was an indoor outdoor school. And so a lot of the doors were like glass. And I remember like getting ready for school in the morning thinking, oh, okay, I think I look good or whatever. And then I would see my reflection and I was mortified. I was like, oh my God, I'm just some big fat pig, you know? And I had a sister who, I still have a sister. She's 3 years younger than I am. And she was cute and adorable and got lots of nice attention, none of which she liked, but you know, it was such a reverse to me and just added to sort of the level of humiliation. So I took on the role of being the funny girl, the really nice girl, you know, and there are part, you know, who I am, that is generally, I'm a kind person, but it was sort of a, like a wax over the reality of what I was living. And, you know, I suffered from depression and things like that in different periods of my life. And because so much of it was just squashing down and squashing down and squashing down, and I had food to put on top of that. So on some level, I didn't really have to let it sink in. And so when I came into program, a couple of things happened for me. Was that one, when I remember being in my first meeting, and actually I'd gone to a meeting once when I was in college, and I forget, I walked in and there were two women in there. It was right before Thanksgiving. And that was probably the first time I heard the 12 steps. I didn't really know about AA, you know, there wasn't anybody in my family or extended family that was involved in 12 steps. And these two women were in the meeting, and one of whom actually I knew from the church I grew up in. So I certainly wasn't going to say anything because she knew who I was. And then the other gal was talking about going home for Thanksgiving, and she was worried about her food and what she was going to eat. And I remember sitting there thinking, all I think about is food. I don't need to come to a place to talk about how much I think about food. And I was like, whatever, you know. But the point is, I just wasn't ready. And to be honest, at that point, I probably had another like 75 pounds to gain at least. So when I came in my late 20s, what I noticed was like people would get up and they would share and everybody would clap and they would sit back down. And I was like, there was no like coming to talk to them afterwards about what they said. And all they got was like, thank you so much for sharing. And like, I really relate. And I was like, oh, wow. Like there was a level of like, you can just be who you are. And people aren't going to criticize you for it. And that was not an experience I'd had, you know? And then I remember reading the steps, they were on the wall, and I was like, huh. And I noticed that God was in pretty much every single one of them. And I thought, well, that's really interesting too. Because a relationship with God was something that I had, and that was something that had, I was raised in a particular faith. But aside from that, I'd had some pretty pivotal faith experiences. But as far as food and body, and why would God want anything to do with that? Like, it didn't make sense to me. I mean, like in my mind, I thought, well, there's starving children all over the place. So why would God care about what's on my plate, you know? And I actually, I mean, my relationship with my higher power was open enough to the extent that I could get really pissed off at my higher power. I would apologize later, but like I was able to be authentic. So I think there was something about being in the rooms and hearing how people shared with each other that there was an authenticity. So I was curious. And you know, when the, so actually that was the second meeting that I had gone to. The first meeting I went to, there was a woman who shared there who was an anorexic. And again, she started talking and I thought, well, okay, not eating is not my problem. Maybe if I didn't eat, it wouldn't be a problem. But you know what? She sat down with me after the meeting and she gave me of her time. And she said, you know what? She said, if you didn't hear something today that you relate to, she said, I just suggest you go to 6 meetings before you decide anything. And I was like, I can do that. You know, and the next morning I actually went to, some of you might be familiar with Serenity Sunday, and I went to the newcomers meeting, because one of the things about me is that when I make a decision, I make a decision. And I think that played a really pivotal role, because it talks about, you know, in chapter 5, which was just read, that, you know, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And so I made a decision. I was at least going to, before I made any decisions, you know. And so I went to that meeting and I remember I was looking in the big book and I said, so where are these steps? And she's like, oh, okay. And she put in around like page 50. So, and I thought, what book waits to the page 50 to get to the point? I thought, that's interesting. And then of course it was all this stuff about alcohol. And I was like, I'm not an alcoholic. Like I can take a sip of wine and leave it. I don't care. And I think I raised my hand during the newcomers meeting, was like, how does this supposed to relate to food? Now I have no idea what they said, because I wasn't really ready for the answer. I wanted to be able to ask the question and not have them throw me out or something. And then that night I went to this meeting where I saw the steps on the wall. And then I went again to a meeting the next day. And by that time I was like, okay, there's something here. There's something about this place. And it's clear that I belong, because I need help. You know, and so I'm a very good rule follower. I got a sponsor. She helped me establish an abstinence, which is what my abstinence start with, 3 meals a day, nothing in between, 2 optional snacks. At that point, we hadn't identified alcoholic foods. That was not how she operated. And she began to sort of take me through the steps. And she said, you know, call me whenever you need to. So, of course, I didn't call her because I didn't want to bother her. And so 3 months in, you know, I'm still absent. I'm going to maybe 1 or 2 meetings or something, and I'm a mess. And there was this very powerful speaker in the meeting. And of course, I asked her if she would sponsor me. And she literally took my hand and grabbed the hand of this other woman and said, here, work with her. I think that one was just as startled. But she provided some structure for me. She said, you're going to call me at this time every morning. She said, you need to go at least 3 meetings, you know, and then she wanted me to call and give her my food. And I was afraid. I was really afraid to. So she just said to me, how about my sponsee? You call my sponsee and you, at the end of the night, you tell her what you had eaten. Because part of my experience growing up was that I was chided for food that went in my mouth. And so I thought, I don't want to do that, you know? And so when I started doing that, and she, brave soul that she was, a couple months into working with her, was like, what would you think about going without sugar for 30 days? And I was like, all right, you know, like, and the only thing I can contribute that willingness to was that there was that time when I wasn't, there was space in between eating meals. Because during the day when I was teaching, it wasn't an issue. I ate breakfast, I had lunch, but then like after school, it was on. And I pretty much would eat until I passed out. In fact, I don't even know how I did my job, to be honest with you, because I spent so much of my time eating. But anyway, so there was something about like having that space. So I said, okay, you know, and actually what I did was, it was the beginning of Lent. So I did it for 40 days. And at the end of that, and I, that meant a regular sugar, which I'm regular sugar. Yeah, regular sugar, yeah, regular soda. So even that wasn't a food, like I knew I couldn't like not have blatant sugar and be drinking soda. Like it was just too obvious, even though we hadn't talked about liquids. And that was probably the harder piece, because I could drink that all day long, even at school. And it was, I mean, I thought like my nerves were coming undone. Like I thought, oh my God, you know, and I just was like, okay, you know, and I just really threw myself into the literature, into, you know, really paying attention when I was in meetings, et cetera. And when I got to the end of that time period, I had some blatant sugar. And for the first time in my life, I could feel it going through my body. And this was sort of a pivotal experience for me, because that was the first time I'd ever noticed it. And that moment I made, I guess, the beginning of a living amends to my body, where I literally was like, you know what? I had no idea, and I'm so sorry. And when I think about all this stuff that I've been pummeling into this body for all these years, you know, and I thought, I don't want to do that anymore. And so from that point forward, that blatant sugar went on my abstinence, and I haven't had a bite since. And that's miraculous. And that's, you know, when they talk about, like it just looks like cardboard to me. Like it doesn't, I don't entertain it, you know. And you know, years later, I find myself, I was in we were doing this school activity where a currency was candy. So I literally am in my classroom with like boxes of this stuff, and it was in my car. And it was like, there was, you know, before program, I would have had to go out and replace what I'd eaten, because, you know, I mean, just like madness. Just like growing up, I remember if somebody had ice cream in the house, like I would eat out of the bottom of the thing and then I'd have to go out and replace it. And of course I'd then have to eat what, so it didn't look like anybody had touched it. I mean, just the lengths to which my disease took me is ridiculous. It's sad, actually, is what it is. So, you know, for me, part of my experience there was that when I stopped eating sugar, I had a lot of, traumatic memories surfaced for me that were really difficult. And so I stayed abstinent, but there's a lot of things that one can eat when they're not eating sugar. But I stayed within the three meals. And that was something I just sort of wrote out, I guess, for a couple months, you could say. And I was in a transition space with my sponsor. And then after that year of abstinence, I remember actually I was sitting in a women's meeting, and in the meeting, the person could read up to a page of literature and then share their experience. And the woman was reading from the doctor's opinion. And she, you know, she read the part where it says, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And I was like, And I remember looking at myself and looking at the women in the meeting and looking at my body and going, well, I'm still, I'd lost about 25 pounds, but I knew I was still overweight. I still had a lot to go. And I thought, well, I'm either doing this or I'm not doing it. And I was like, I'm going to do it, you know? And so that was that decision, you know? I think what's interesting is, I don't know if it's in Bill's story or in the doctor's opinion or whatever, or in the beginning readings where it talks about how as addicts or alcoholics or whatever, make a lot of resolutions, but never a decision, right? And so again, it's that key piece of that, like when step five, it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. And so for whatever reason, maybe I needed that year of abstinence that wasn't super tight or whatever, with enough room to fall on my face, and still be okay and not get kicked out, not that y'all are going to kick me out, but that then I reached a level of willingness where I literally would be, you know, I would stand naked on a fire hydrant on some corner somewhere, even at, you know, 200 whatever pounds, and dance and sing if you told me that was going to keep me abstinent. I was so willing to do whatever it was. So I actually ended up getting another sponsor, and she, you know, she really honed it in. I'd started working on my steps, but we went back to the beginning of the big book. And she took me through the big book and the A 12 and 12, because she was around, she started went before there was OA literature. And she had me committing my food in advance, which is something I hadn't done before. I had to get on the scale once a week, which I hated. She said, you need to pray and meditate every day. She said, you're going to call me at this time. And she said, and you better pray and meditate before you call me, because I don't want to be talking to your disease. You know, like she didn't play around, but she was 100-pounder and she kept her weight off for like 15, 16 years or something at the time. And I really wanted what she had. And she said to me, this program has to be the most important thing without exception. You have to work as though your life depends on it. And that's exactly what I did. And that's what I still do. You know, so many of those things I still do. Now, since then, I've added foods to my abstinence, particular foods. But I still pray and meditate every day. I still get on the scale once a week. I still commit my food ahead of time. You know, I do 10 steps, gratitude lists, all that kind of stuff. I'm of service. You know, all the things they say to do. And sometimes I think, And I've had people ask me over the years, like, well, you know, don't you ever like lag on a certain thing? And it's like, I don't know which one is going to be the ball that's going to drop them all, you know? So I'm not really interested in like, oh, let's see if I don't do this. You know, I remember I was absent a few years and I was out visiting for like a family gathering or extended family gathering. And I happened to be there with a couple of fellows who wanted to go to the town and hang out and stuff. And we all had this particular like commercial food plan that we were following. And they were like, we're not going to do that this weekend. And I was like, you have fun. Like, I don't get that luxury. Like, again, it comes back to that thing of, you know, it talks about in chapter 3, which I just love, on page 30, that, you know, the idea that someday, somehow, I might be a normal eater has to be smashed. And I remember that early on in the mornings, there was a meeting I went to on Saturday mornings, that was the reading they read instead of chapter 5. And I remember being like, oh, right. So I would always picture the episode from the Brady Bunch where the kids broke the vase or the vase and glued it back together and then like put the flowers. And of course the water came out. And of course mom threw fit or whatever. But I was like, oh, it's like that. I have to break that idea entirely. And it's not going to get put back together, you know? And I mean, on some level, I guess one could begrudge that, but like, as opposed to what, like trying to pretend I give it like, and normal, by the way, in my experience is highly overrated. Like, it's so ridiculous. Like, okay, so I make phone calls when I'm going to somebody's wedding reception to see if I can find the caterer to find out what's being served. Or, you know, like I map out where to go to a grocery store when I'm traveling somewhere. Like I pack food with me just in case. Like when I go to potluck, sometimes I eat as part of the potluck. Sometimes I bring my own food. Like if that's what it means because I'm not normal around food, fine. The whole point in most of these experiences, oddly enough, my own surprise, is to actually be there and enjoy the people. And if my head is spinning about what I'm eating or what I'm not eating, what's there, blah, blah, I can't do that, you know? And when I think about how like the simplicity of knowing the truth and the reality of my disease gives me this freedom. And yes, it requires a level of discipline, but discipline, strangely enough, is freedom. Like there's all kinds of strange things about this program that just outside don't make any sense, that like discipline equals freedom, and that doing things I don't want to do gives me a life that I have a great deal of esteem about, and I can feel good about who I am, you know? And when I think about how, you know, these steps, it's like they're, you know, you get to the 12th step and it says, we practice these principles in all our affairs. And like, strangely enough, like it works in my work life. It works in my personal life. It works in my financial life. It works everywhere, you know? And I have a 12-step exercise that I'll like take an issue through, and I'll do my writing and all these tools that we have, and being a sponsor, which is hard, but it's so rewarding when I can be a witness to someone's path of recovery, you know, and the times when like my horrendous experiences that I've been through, you know, when I had to deal with like family situations and I get off a phone call and I'm in the fetal position curled up on the floor because I've been so hurt or whatever. And that somehow is helpful to someone, you know, because by the way, and I didn't eat over it, you know, or I find myself so crippled by resentment that I didn't even realize was like behind the curtain there. And it comes like rearing into my face and I become face to face with who I am and what's going on, going, oh, yuck, you know? And what I actually find is that like when I get down into those dark places, you know, that I've been running from or stuffing down over the years with food, that like God is usually there and he's like, oh, good, you're here. Now we can get to work on this. There's no like, where have you been? What's your problem? Like, that's all my head. You know, that's all my disease going, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, that was something else that really shifted for me. I think growing up, probably in part because of some of my experiences, but like, I kept wanting to like God to like swoop in and rescue me. And I don't even mean from like difficult situations. I mean, just from life, because life is difficult, you know, but it's also beautiful. But even some of the beauty sometimes I can't handle. Like it's, I feel things deeply, and it's taken me a long time to admit that, you know. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the food with my feelings cut off. Like I admire newcomers who come in, like they can't stop crying, you know, because I couldn't even cry when I came in. The only thing that would get me to cry in the first few years was to have a discussion with my sponsor about how I ate less food. I need to eat less food. That always gets me crying. Always, you know. And anyway, so what part of what shifted for me in my experience of higher power, amongst other things, I mean, it's changed so much over the years, but one of the big things was that I was no longer looking for this God to rescue me. What I needed instead was a God that like had there, that was at my back and would walk with me through whatever it was, you know? And I actually remember very clearly, I had this experience once. I was at the OA birthday party in LA, and I think it was that Saturday or something. And I decided to go, you know, the hotel was not too far from right along the coast. So I actually went and parked my car and walked out onto the sand. And it was pretty late and it was cold and stuff. And I had this experience of standing there. And I don't know what it was I was going through at the time. There's been so many things over the years, I sort of lose track, but it must have been a strong experience for me. And I felt this presence behind me. And I also felt like God had his arms around me and he was cracking open my chest, and it hurt. It hurt really bad. And I felt like I heard him say, I know this hurts, but we got to open this up so that you can let some of the anger out, because there's a lot more love in there, but we need to open this up. And he's like, I know it's going to hurt, but I'm with you. I got you on this. And, you know, that's just one of the experiences that I've had, and that I'm continually amazed at the things that I can do that used to baffle me. You know, they talk about that and the promises, like, and how this happens, because, you know, I did this inventory and I took stock of how I'd been living, and I know what my character defenses are and how I can surrender those and wait and continually act in the other direction, like it talks about in step 6 and 7, and trust that God's timing as to when they will be removed, and that it's, some of them it's a immediate removal, some of them it's a in the moment removal. You know, it's one of the things I love about the 7-step prayer, where it says that, like, of course now I'm going to blank on it, but the idea that, like, I trust that God will remove the defective character that needs to be removed in the situation. That's how I interpret it. And so while in my mind, this particular defective character is a problem and needs to be removed, that may not be God's perspective, you know, and, or maybe that's not the one that's standing in the way, you know, maybe it's something else. And most of the amends that I did, or most of my, or living amends to my family, like I said, I did a lot of internal wreckage. So there's a living amends to myself, and living my program is part of that. You know, shifting my relationship with my body. A lot of that work has come from actually being of service to others. Actually, it's a woman in program come up to me about it, I guess, you know, a few years in or whatever. And she said, somebody asked me to do some body image stuff. And I don't know, I thought maybe you would have like body image issues. I thought, what a funny thing to say to somebody. But, you know, I honestly really hadn't, again, I was still pretty cut off, you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, and I sat and I prayed about it and thought about it and talked to my sponsor. And I was like, well, I think there's something here I can, you know, work with. And then I've since connected with another woman. She and I do this image workshop, where body image workshop. We take people all through all 12 steps. And it's a really powerful experience. But again, it's about bringing God into it. And, you know, when it talks about in Bill's story about how, you know, he says we must perfect and enlarge our spiritual life in order to survive the trouble spots ahead. It reminds me, first of all, that like, I love that Bill doesn't mince words. There's all kinds of places in literature where he says, this is difficult, this is painful, this will be trouble, this is hard. So there's never this notion of like, I'm going to get abstinent, my whole life is going to be wonderful. And I'm really grateful that that's not the perspective I was given, because I would have come into a really harsh realization if that were the case. Because surprise, surprise, I reached a healthy body weight, my life did not magically like materialize into this like Barbie experience, whatever that is. And so there's that piece of it. And then the whole thing about perfecting and enlarging one's spiritual life. And I remember just sort of thinking, oh, okay. So to me, in my mind, that was about like expanding what God could possibly be. And so over the years, like I found myself on shamanic hikes and I read into different literature and I meet different people and I go on various retreats and I explore different types of meditation and stuff. And sometimes it's just as simple as like recognizing that the car that just cut me off in traffic has a bumper sticker on it that like makes me laugh, or that reminds me that God is still present. And I do not have to, even in my head, chew that person out, whatever, because they're not on my timeline, you know, or things that remind me not to take myself so seriously. And, you know, doing that, I do a nightly, if I don't do a formal 10 step, I do a gratitude list when I send my food commitment for the next day. And, you know, that has shifted like the lens through which I see everything. And I go through my day going, oh, that's something I'm grateful for, or that I can put that on my list because I'm looking for different things. Like all those are about like expanding, you know, my perception of a power greater than myself. And it tells us in the big book, the whole purpose of this program is to get us to connect with a power greater than ourselves, because I can't do this on my own. I need you guys. I need my higher power. I need the steps, and I need to be abstinent, because if my head's in the food, like all bets are off, you know, my world gets really, really small and I get really, really big, you know, and my whole, everything's filled with fear. And I don't think I can do one more thing. And, you know, I lose the perspective. There's that 10 minutes left. Okay. I lose the perspective that, like, I'm actually, there's more here than I could ever imagine, you know? And something for me that has been come up recently, you know, it talks about, in the serenity prayer, which we say over and over and over, right? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think all the time that often when I am frustrated or I'm sort of arguing with life, which never goes in my favor, that it's because I'm wrestling with the things I cannot change, you know? And so I recently, in my part of what I do in my daily process is I write a letter to God. And so I say to God, I turn over to you all the things I cannot change and trust in your plans, because that at least is my attempt at the beginning of the day to say, I get it. Like there's a lot of things that I have no control over here, but I'm going to keep trusting in you. And I hope that that will guide me into doing what I can do, you know? And when I first went through the steps, you know, it carried a lot of weight to it, because I had a sense of like, this is something that's really going to make a difference. And it does. And it continues to. And I love that in our literature, you know, like I'm part of this big book meeting and like we'll go through and read. I'm like, I know I read this before, but I don't remember seeing this before. So that's another element of like perfecting and enlarging my spiritual life, that I all of a sudden have new eyes because I'm coming at it from a new experience. And that when I experience rubs and challenges, like I had this thing come up this weekend where I volunteered to coordinate or facilitate this online group of folks to go through this particular study. And someone had these harsh critical feedback pieces for me that were completely unsolicited. And it hurt, you know? And I was like, ouch, you know? And I thought, okay, You know, I go back to that 10-step principle. Every time I'm disturbed by a person, place, or thing, there's something wrong with me. Now, I often say I'm the one who's disturbed because I spent my whole life saying there's something wrong with me. So I don't necessarily need to confirm that idea, but I'm the one who's disturbed, right? So I get to write about that. I get to pray about that. I get to talk to my sponsor about that. And maybe there's something there for me to shift. Maybe it's just the reality. Like I feel things, sometimes they hurt. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to change the course of action. And the gift today is that like, I don't have to eat over it. It doesn't even occur to me to eat over it. I don't have to become super critical of my body about it. I mean, like, you know, the disease sort of morphs and shapes over time, you know, and thank you. And I can still, you know, like have moments where I'm going to some special event or whatever, and I find out what they're serving and what I can potentially eat of that and think, I'm going to die because there's not going to be enough food, you know, and like, because I'm not ever going to be normal around food. So that thought's going to occur to me, but I get, to, because I'm abstinent, I can differentiate the true from the false. You know, it says that in the doctor's opinion, that when we are in the throes of the obsession and the allergy, we cannot differentiate the true from the false. So when I hear those ideas or the thoughts, I can go, nope, thank you for sharing. That's not going to happen. You know, this is not the hill I'm going to die on, you know? And just to wrap up, you know, over 20 years, like, let me just say, this is not where I thought I'd be in my life when I first came into program. It's not where I thought I wanted to be. And on some level, like, cool. Like, it doesn't even really matter. Like, I am who I want to be. Like, I can look at myself in the mirror before I go to bed after brushing my teeth and, like, be at peace with who's looking back at me. You know, when my head hits the pillow, it's not full of like fright and what do I do about this and da da da. Like I fall asleep, you know, and like I have no idea what's coming tomorrow. And yes, there's things that I would like to see happen in my life or whatever, but there's a sense of peace and internal ease that I never thought was possible. And if that means that I got to chop lots of vegetables and commit my food and write gratitude lists and do steps over and over and over again and listen to somebody on the phone, then that's what I'll do because it's priceless, absolutely priceless. And it's such a tremendous gift. And I thank you all for being here, for listening to me go on. And hopefully something I said was helpful. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you very much. It was fabulous, Colleen. I really got